This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And this week's guest is Jeremy Reed. Good afternoon, Jeremy.
Good afternoon, William.
And this piece, I think, is from your website. You were born on a chip of rock off the French Normandy coast.
That's Jersey Channel Islands, yes. Right, okay. Born in a foggy blue bubble.
In a what?
Foggy blue bubble.
How's that? What is it?
Well, because Jersey's invaded by sea fog.
I see. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And you are described as Britain's most dynamic, adventurous, controversial and futures poet. A futures poet?
I would agree, yeah. Okay. A lot of my themes are futuristic, edge of sci-fi beyond.
I see, okay. And called by The Independent, British poetry's glam, spangly, shape-shifting answer to David Bowie. And you are a prolific writer, numerous books of poetry and non-fiction,
mm-hmm.
mostly.
Biographies, yes.
Biographies, yeah. The novels include The Lipstick Boys, Inhabiting Shadows, When the Whip Comes Down, Red Hot Lipstick, where is this poetry list? I can't see that. What would you recommend?
There's so many books. Poetry.
By the Fisheries, Nero, and that was By the Fisheries of 1984, and they go on to the present day. I have to say that when I invited you today, mm-hmm. You responded with an email yesterday in which you said, "It's not a part of the world I like." Is that referring to, is that South London generally?
Or? Yeah, I guess so, in the sense that, you know, I've lived most of my time in northwest London,
yeah.
in Hampstead, and I guess most of my writing time is spent there and in Soho, of course, which I've inhabited for a long time as a yeah. resident poet.
Right, okay. So, and that's where I see you mostly, isn't it?
That's right. I tend to ride a patisserie Valerie in Old Compton Street,
yeah.
largely because the staff are so friendly and because they sell the only tea I drink, Lapsang Souchong.
I see. Oh, okay. What about the Maison Berthaud? Do they not do...
They sell Lapsang Souchong, which is a fermented black China tea with a very smoky scent. But I prefer Patisserie Valerie. It's more time, space to write, friendliness.
Yeah.
It's the last of perhaps Soho's bohemia.
Right. And you, because the French isn't what it was, do you think?
I've always found the French house too small. It's a bit like a living room for me.
Right, okay. Did you go to the Colony?
Only sometimes with Francis Bacon or with Aaron from Red Snapper Books.
Oh, yes. Aaron Budnick?
Yes, Aaron Budnick.
With whom you have a sort of working relationship of sorts?
Yes, we share a huge passion and enthusiasm for fine first edition books, rare books, common interests in counterculture literature, etc.
Yeah.
And I worked for Aaron for a short time, 2 or 3 years at Red Snapper Books in Cecil Court, where I wrote at the desk and also combined that with serving wonderful customers like Pete Doherty and whoever else came to the shop.
Yeah. I remember if I walked down Cecil Court, I would see you in the shop. And if I ever went in the shop, you were always writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite envious of that ability to basically write wherever you are. And in fact, when we met next door, sort of 20 minutes ago, you had your notebook open then, you're writing. Mm. So you seem to be able to write poetry wherever you are.
Yes, I never believe in wasting time because it's a limited resource. Yes, I've always been able to write anywhere, on aircraft, buses, walking down the street, cafes, just at home, wherever.
Right.
Because if it's always in you, it's always accessible. You know, to me, I always say to people, it's like just putting on a light switch and there it is.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, if you live in imagination all the time, you don't have to make much of a journey to reach it. I think if you're a part-time writer, it's quite a long journey back sometimes to access where you left off.
Right.
Whereas if you're doing it all the time, you're always immersed in it.
Right, right. So do you write novels as well, or just
I write novels, I write biographies, I write pop lyrics, I write poetry.
Who have you written pop lyrics for?
I've written a couple of albums for Mark Almond. We did Against Nature, in which I put the very infamous decadent French novel Arabour Against Nature into 16 songs for him, and we worked together on Feasting for Panthers, again songs I'd written for him, and very free adaptions of French poems that he wanted to do by Jean Genet, Baudelaire, etc.
Right. So he's a friend of yours, or?
Yes, and we've always greatly admired each other's work, and to me, Mark is the singularly great pop voice.
Right, yeah.
Right from the first time I heard him singing Los Qualita off Soft Cell's third album, This Last Night in Sodom, I embraced him as the great pop diva.
Right, okay. And you've written a book about him?
I wrote a book about Mark, yes, in the sort of mid-90s called The Last Star.
Oh, okay. So what's Piccadilly Bongo then?
Piccadilly Bongo is a book of my poems to which Mark contributed a CD of Soho original songs.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. So if you buy Piccadilly Bongo, the book, you get a CD by
of
Mark Arnold.
Original Mark songs, yes.
And that's Any Tharmon Press 2010. But tell me again, I'm trying to find it on this list. What was the one you mentioned with him?
With Mark, we did Piccadilly Bongo, but we did an album called Against Nature and another called Feasting with Panthers, both of which came out from Strike Force via Cherry Red.
Right. Okay. And, you will probably recite some poetry later, but just to keep on this book dealing issue, have you ever been a book dealer yourself?
Much more a collector. I have a vast library.
Right.
I started knowing about books, and it really is a knowledge. I started knowing about books probably from the age of 12, 13, when my mother would buy me books of poetry I wanted, but always in very good first editions.
Okay.
It's a kind of fetish amongst book collectors.
Yeah.
And so I don't actively deal, but I do, if I have duplicates and triplicates, very often sell them, as right. I tend to have right. multiples of books I love.
Okay. But I always associated with book dealers. I associate you with book dealers, with Red Snapper Books. And I remember going to Ulysses, where Peter Jolliffe used mm-hmm. to sit. And he was a sort of, was he an unpublished poet of sorts?
He probably was. I never read his poetry, but I spent a great deal of time at any amount of books on Charing Cross Road,
right.
where I buy a large number of books and know the staff very well. And that is probably the most fabulous bookshop one could ever find.
Right.
Constant renewal of stock.
Yes.
Perfect staff. Yes, that's one of the my places.
Right. Peter Jolliffe used to be in Ulysses, of course.
Peter was at Ulysses.
I can't think of it. Museum Street.
That was Museum Street. Yeah. Peter's books were in the very top end range, price-wise.
Yeah.
Person who worked for him, the wonderful Peter Ellis, who's on Cecil Court, he bought most of Peter Jolliffe's stock. But yes, because I have a very, very vast, almost encyclopedic knowledge of modern first editions,
right.
I do know, yes, a lot about books.
Mm. So that must make you very useful to have as a person in the bookshop.
Oh, yes, if I go into bookshops.
To deal with people.
I'm able to advise the staff as to what they should be
Absolutely.
Charging, etc. Yeah, it's just what I call a knowledge.
Okay. And that, in turn, sort of possibly leads to Martin Stone. Who was the, well, described, I think, by Ian Sinclair as being probably the greatest book runner ever. Is that fair?
Yes, Martin was king of books. Martin was incomparable. His extraordinary, inimitable abilities to access rare books, to sell them at prices that were affordable, both to individuals and dealers. Martin was very much post-60s in his dress, in his look, in his wonderful idealism.
Hmm.
He ran books to most major shops and collectors. He also bought books for Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones, etc.
Right.
Martin was just, yes, a complete one-off.
Yes. He would be seen, I used to see him sometimes going up and down the Charing Cross Road. Always a very striking figure.
Very striking figure.
Very thin, but with quite precisely tailored suits quite often, and quite long shoes and a hat. Quite a striking person. And it turns out that he was actually a guitarist, wasn't he? He was a respected rock guitarist.
He was a great slide guitarist. It was rumoured that after Brian Jones was murdered, Martin was going to join the Rolling Stones. In fact, he showed me press cuttings saying that he was going to be the substitute, which turned out, in fact, to be Mick Taylor. But Martin was certainly in line.
Right.
He would often...
Just sorry to interrupt, but that's quite a controversial thing to say, that Brian Jones was murdered, isn't it? My understanding was he drowned in the swimming pool of A.A. Milne's house that he owned.
I think that's a generally accepted view. I wrote a book on Brian Jones called The Last Decadent, in which I did some considerable research.
Uh-huh.
And I think recent books have confirmed that without doubt he was murdered. He was either asphyxiated in his own swimming pool or killed and then put in the swimming pool.
Right. Wow.
Martin, to refer to the theme of Martin Stone, after Brian was fired by the Rolling Stones, Martin joined what was putatively Brian's new band. He went to Cotchford Farm, recorded with him. He said Brian was largely playing electronica then. He didn't want to use guitars. And Steve Marriott was going to be the vocalist. And Martin has, or had, an actual rehearsal tape which he could never find, which to Stones collectors would, of course, be the ultimate find.
Right.
He recorded one of the sessions at Cotchford Farm with Brian in the music room, so he told me.
Uh-huh. Okay. And you knew Martin Stone quite well?
I knew Martin very well on the level of books. He would come to see me in Hampstead, and he would invariably, with great generosity, give me books that I wanted. Martin was somebody you could phone up and tell him you were looking for something rare, and within an hour he'd call you back and say, I've got it.
Wow, yeah.
And he would say to me, poets don't pay for books.
And he's sort of immortalised in some of Ian Sinclair's books, I think. Is it Down River and at least one other, where he's a sort of character in the
Scarlet Tracings.
Yeah.
And yes, Martin was very close to Ian, who of course is another major book knowledge dealer.
Right.
Martin, of course, also played with bands like The Action, with whom we started the program,
yeah.
and the Pink Fairies, guested as a session musician with a lot of people, played with a psychedelic outfit called Mighty Baby,
uh-huh.
and continued to play guitar right to the end of his life, a lot of it in Paris, guesting for artists. He played absolutely superb liquid slide.
Right, okay. And what happened to him then?
Martin was a chain, very heavy smoker, alcoholic much of his life, cocaine much of his life, and Martin sadly began to suffer illnesses caused from that sort of constellation of abuse.
Right, okay.
And died of cancer last year.
Oh, really? Only a year ago?
Only a year ago, yes. Okay. An immense loss to all of us who loved him. He was a very quiet, gentle, idealistic, beautiful person in every way.
Right, okay. So that we had various tracks by The Action. I'm not familiar with The Action, particularly with their music. They are sort of revered, I think, by people like Paul Weller and so on, who have reissued, I think, the singles or perhaps wrote a piece as an introduction to a compilation album of The Action. Did you see The Action play?
No, I never saw The Action play, but... No. I learnt about them largely through Martin Stone and from reading books about mods, and that they were a great club band. Their chart successes were limited, but they became a sort of legend, particularly with their vocalist Reg King, who had that very stylized, bluesy vocal. And most recently, Mark Almond has released an album called Shadows and Reflections, which is covers largely of 60s torch ballads and pop songs he admires, and the title track, Shadows and Reflections, was a single by The Action.
Okay.
It seems that The Action never charted, never made an album, but had a tremendous ambience club following, which Paul Weller, naturally as a mod supremacist, got onto later.
Right. And, they were possibly one of those bands that were better live, maybe?
I'm sure.
More sort of atmosphere there.
I'm sure. They would have played in that tiny scene club, now the site of Ham Hotel. They would have played in Ham Yard at the scene club, which I believe was their main site of action, and the Marquee Club.
Okay, yes. And you did a performance, I think, in Ham Yard.
Yes, I did a lot of performances in Ham Yard before the reconstruction took place, particularly with a photographer called Gregory Hess, from which a book was issued called just Ham Yard.
Right, okay.
I performed in that space for him when we knew it was going to be demolished. We'd read on the net that it was going to be reconstructed as a luxury hotel,
right,
which it now is.
So... was that sort of in homage to that scene, as it were?
It was in homage to, yes, a forgotten Soho. It used to be a bomb site, that yard, where you could go and write in the afternoon. People like Derek Jarman hung out there. Francis Bacon would go in there and drink. It was a sort of general site. The homeless would sleep there.
Right.
And it remained so right up until about 8 years ago. And the black peeling walls of the old scene club were still there.
Really? Oh, okay.
You couldn't enter it.
Oh, my God.
So reading about it and its history, as Gregory Hess and I did, we decided we would commemorate it by a series of film performances of mine.
Right.
So that's what we did.
So it is worth mentioning, you are a performance poet as well.
Very much so, yes.
With what's the name of your you have a sort of a trio, is it?
Yes, I perform poetry rather than read it, and I find most poetry readings very boring. I perform poetry with the Ginger Light, which comprises Jerry McNee, and a harpist called Maria Christina.
Okay. Would you care to recite some poetry now? Would this be an opportune moment, or should we?
I can read a poem from a new book called Candy for Cannibals, published by Enothamon Press. So I'll read a poem that I usually do with the Ginger Light. It's called You're Gonna Hear From Me. Maybe one day, some foggy day, My algorithm will come up buying dress rings at Jubilee markets. Pink paste, marine turquoise as an obsessive fetish, fetish, fetish. Or allied off Maiden Lane in a furred Covent Garden artery, where I found a woman's red shoe like the one in Bowie's Let's Dance, discarded like a reject, and keep it at home as hoodoo, 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 a size 5 geranium red bally, as part of what I do, crunch all the bits together of what I selectively see. Maybe today's the right day, my chemical signature peaks, instructing you by telepathy to exit the red central line and pretend you're looking for me, 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 as a pineapple-shaped idea made into a reality. And we'll go tracking each other under the radar, you and me, on the circle line forever, 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 forever.
It's marvellous. What is that one called?
That's called You're Gonna Hear From Me.
Okay.
Like and is the that old blues song.
And is it?
Mm.
Okay.
Billie Holiday sings a song called You're Gonna Hear From Me.
Right, right. And that's from your latest, I've nearly said album, but it's a...
yeah, Candy for Cannibals, okay. Which was my most recent book of poetry, yeah.
Okay. So how many books of poems have you published now?
I don't know. I never keep count.
You've lost track.
Yeah, I'm always only interested in the new one that I'm writing or the next poem that I'm writing. Okay. I think, you know, you only write a book in order to move on to the next. You leave that behind because there's better things to say.
Right.
Because all books are just approximations. You never get it right. So you're always trying to write the one book that could come right, but of course it never will because that's the nature of the game.
So you've written biographies of Brian Jones, Mark Almond, Lou Reed, and one called The Dilly Boys.
Yes, I wrote a book called The Dilly, A Secret History of Piccadilly Rent Boys.
Right. Could you tell me anything about that?
Yes, that's the first book on what was regarded at one time as quite an honourable trade, rent boys at Piccadilly, of which I knew quite a lot of people who worked there during the times when that particular scene was active. So I decided, as it was such a taboo subject and largely off limits, to write about it, to retrieve it historically.
Hmm. What period is this when you say it was active?
I guess it would have started around the time of Oscar Wilde in the 1890s.
Okay.
But the people I interviewed were active there, say, largely in the 70s and 80s. It finished in the late 80s largely due to CCTV and the fact that gay life had become ghettoized, and therefore the sort of isolated attraction between the punter and the rent boy was no longer needed.
Hmm. Right.
But it's a history, an excavation, which also brings in mods, Francis Bacon, who I knew well, a very colourful cast of people who I interviewed who'd worked there during largely in the 80s and late 70s.
And I think you suggest that I think David Bowie and Mark Boland were both, participants.
Well, I think Pete Townsend gave us the knowledge that Mark Boland acquired his vast wardrobe at such a young age from working at Piccadilly Circus.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Bowie ever did. Bowie lived with Ken Pitt, of course, at Manchester Street in Fitzrovia, and Ken was, of course, gay, but we don't know a great deal about their private relationship.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that possibly leads nicely onto this mod issue, which I'd like to talk to you about. You wrote a book, The King of Carnaby Street, The Life of John Stephen, which is obviously all about John Stephen, who started Carnaby Street. When did you publish the book? When did that come out? Approximately.
I'm not sure, 2010 or something, or 2012 perhaps.
Okay. And what drew you to this subject?
I think in terms of nonfiction, I've always liked to rehabilitate great outsiders who are somehow gone neglected.
Mm.
very few people realize that Carnaby Street as a complex, as the most popular international fashion barrio of the 60s, was singularly created by a young Scotsman called John Stephen, who came to London at 18, and together with his partner Bill Franks, set up in a single room in Beak Street in 1956, attracting pop star customers like Cliff Richards and Billy Fury of their era. Moved into Carnaby Street in the early 60s, and by their improvised homemade shops and by the extraordinary clothes John designed, created that whole street, which throughout the 60s became probably the most fashionable youth culture focus in London or in Europe.
At that point, perhaps we should play a bit of...
Friends all ask me about you. You're gone, and they want to know why. I've stopped even trying to tell them. Tears fill my eyes, I walk away. What can I say? Where can I go without your love? What should I tell them now that you've left me? What should I say? What can I do? I'm lost without you. If I've made you unhappy, I'm sorry for what I've done wrong. You can't really mean it's all over. Give me a chance, don't walk away. Hear what I say. What can I do? I'm lost without you.
Listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. This week's guest is Jeremy Reed, author of The King of Carnaby Street, The Life of John Stephen, amongst numerous other books of poetry and non-fiction. That was Billy Fury, and you sort of selected that track out of all of those. Why was that? You have a connection with this track, I think.
Yes, very much so. Certainly when I was researching my book on John Stephen, his partner, Bill Franks, who was alive, told me a lot of stories about Billy Fury coming to their first shops, and how carefully he'd arranged his hair. And surprisingly, Bill said for the time, and it was unusual, Billy Fury was always wearing eye makeup off stage. He bought particularly mohair jumpers from them, suits, shirts. And then later on, because that song lives by its loneliness, by its blue ambience. Mark Almond recorded recently on his 60s covers, Shadows and Reflections, and the band I perform with, the Ginger Light, we do a poem by me called Lost Without You, in which we sample parts of that track. Amongst all Billy Fury's work, it has that haunting melancholy, completely downbeat attitude of lost love that is still transcended, which is what is so admirable about him.
There's usually a sort of an echo, isn't there?
Yes, there's always an echo to increase and amplify that feeling of lostness.
With the sound of an orchestra, which sounds like it's sort of half a mile away.
Yes, in order to isolate Fury's own melancholy.
Right. I'm particularly interested in that period. I'm particularly interested in that sort of pre-John Stephen period, when there was a shop called Vince, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
Which was, even until maybe 15 years ago, if you were in that area, if you were near Marshall Street, near the Marshall Street Baths, you could look up and you'd still see the word Vince sort of painted on the side of a building, presumably where the shop had been.
Yes.
And that was a sort of legendary pre-Carnaby Street shop.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about Vince?
Yes, that was London's first male boutique, which I researched quite extensively in the course of writing my book on John Stephen, receiving first-hand information from Bill Franks. According to Bill Franks, a physique photographer called Bill Green set up Vince probably around 1950. It was arguably the first male boutique in London.
Right.
Certainly in Soho, and Newburgh Street at that time was a very run-down red light alley. Bill Green set up largely as a physique photographer, taking photos of males in the Marshall Street bars. And his photographs of considerable artistic merit were published in magazines like Physique. The attraction to the boutique Vince was, according to Bill Franks, that in order to amplify the physical assets of his models, Bill Green devised very small bikini briefs for them to wear in the photos. These became so popular with people viewing them in magazines that he actually set up a business initially for male bikini underwear, and then progressed into knitwear, into imported French and Italian clothes of very unusual nature, which in turn, of course, attracted mods by the late 50s, who wanted white skinny jeans and matelot vests and the sort of things that he was selling. I believe, according to Billy, he had a very hard time. His windows were periodically broken by irate neighbours who thought that the clothes really weren't suitable for men.
Yeah.
And Sean Connery actually was one of his models, and early Sean Connery photos are on some of the catalogues.
Right. And I think, didn't you say that he tried to have these destroyed?
Totally. I think
that would be quite difficult, I think, going back that far and trying to destroy all those images would be virtually impossible, I should think.
Yes. Certainly in my John Stephen book, there is a photo of him as a model, but we weren't allowed to use his name for fear of legal reprisals.
Right.
Apparently it's a period which he wishes to suppress
in
his personal history. It was a time when he was voted, according to my researches, I think, third in Mr. Scotland or something like that, and subsequently became a male model.
Right, right. And interestingly, I think that you somewhere in the book, you refer to the fact that there was a magazine actually called Mod. It was called Mod, and it was probably a catalogue of some sort, perhaps, and presumably published in the 50s. And that would predate the whole of that sort of mod phase by several years, even though, you know, people assume that the word mod came about in the early 60s. But
yes.
That word must have been bandied about with a different association.
Yes, and I think anyhow, demographically, mods probably begin around 57, 58, and that they start to wear suits which have deliberate and determined personality. They start to wear Italian clothes. According to my researchers, with Bill Franks, he was absolutely implicit that mods had started in the late 50s yeah. and were seeking out their unusual clothes, like unusual knitwear and leather ties and very sharp jackets and button-down collar shirts, tab collar shirts, which John was already, of course, making.
So John Stephen, there was a brief period when he worked at Vince or for
Yes, Vince? He worked at Vince, he said, for about 3 months. Perhaps more as a sort of surveillance to see what sort of people would come. Because when John Stephen set up in Carnaby Street was literally a bomb site. Mm. There was only, according to Bill Franks, the electricity board there and a tobacconist called Underwicks, which continued throughout the 60s.
Right.
But the street was completely deserted. They moved there because the rent was so cheap. They paid, I think, under £10 a week for a shop,
right.
which they hand-painted, made all the props, designs, etc. for the shop. So that for mods, it became... Shopping became for the first time recreational. They entered into an interior like they hadn't seen before, which was purple and yellow and orange,
right.
very carefully hung by John's window dresser, Miles Anthony, who used the suspended Swiss method of dropping the clothes down from the ceiling in diagonals.
Right.
And of course, they were introduced to a range of colours that had never really before been available to men and which were closely identified with woman only.
Right. Right.
I think I did tell you the story that Bill Franks did about the actual first mods to come to their shop, how for weeks they would hear scooters in the grid moving round and round and round, and that youths would come and look at the shop and stand off on their scooters but not enter until one afternoon Bill said one of them came into the shop who wanted a particular jumper. Had the courage to ask for it and buy it, and after that they were invaded with thousands and thousands and thousands every week.
Right, okay. And this is The Miracles from 1960. Keep your freedom for as long as you can. My mama told me you better shop around. The Miracles, Shop Around 1960, which seems fairly appropriate for the theme. Tell me a bit more. You met Bill Franks. How did you come to meet Bill Franks? What led to this acquaintanceship?
I'd always planned to write a book about John Stephen, and I began writing a novel about him, which was later published as Here Comes the Nice. But I went to the V&A. I discovered online that John Stephen's archive was deposited at the V&A. I went along there to research and discovered there was a vast archive of 72 boxes, cuttings, photographs of the whole mod era, which I found, of course, extraordinarily fascinating. In the course of researching these, one of the staff said to me, "I'm so glad you're writing about John Stephen, as he's been so neglected." I remembered that a friend had shown me a little bit of footage of John Stephen, which was somehow appended to the end of a particular rock show in which he was with his partner, Bill Franks. So, assuming Bill Franks may well have been dead, I asked the assistant at the V&A if he was, and she said, "No, he comes regularly to help if we need assistance with the archive." And so via them, I wrote a letter to Bill. They suggested they would pass on a letter to Bill as he was offline. I've duly heard from Bill, perhaps when I'd given up about 6 weeks later. He'd been in Spain and he phoned me up and he said, "Come over tomorrow." So that was the beginning of a very happy association of my going over there to Peninsula Heights, where he lived in a very beautiful apartment overlooking Whitehall and the Thames. And he retrieved the whole story of Carnaby Street and John Stephen for me so that I had first-hand information, which probably nobody else ever will have in relation to John Stephen, who was a very, very reclusive, private, generally inaccessible individual, even at the height of the 60s.
So Bill Franks was his lifelong partner?
Yes, they met when they were about 18, 19 and remained together. Bill was there right to John's last breath.
Right. And did they live on German Street?
They lived on German Street during the height of the 60s, yes.
Right.
In an old block there. And they had a Rolls Royce then, which John largely used to attract the media.
Right.
As such a young man, having a Rolls Royce at that time was quite anomalous.
Yeah.
And John had great difficulty, according to Bill, in driving it. And then later they imported the first magenta-coloured Cadillac to Carnaby Street also,
right,
which was quite risque given the period that American cars weren't really around.
Yeah. He apparently, I think in your book, the suggestion is that he suffered from depression throughout his life. Is that?
Yes, John was bipolar. That seemed to run genetically in his family. It didn't really precipitate until his mid-20s. His one journey to America to promote the John Stephen line there initialized a major breakdown on his return, sort of psychotic delusional episodes for which he was incarcerated at the Priory.
Wow.
Thereafter, the regular episodes of bipolar started.
Right. So you think it was a sort of genetic thing, but he was also a compulsive user of amphetamine. Is that true?
Yes, a user of amphetamines, and also I would think predisposed to depression due to very acute alcoholism.
Right.
Throughout the 60s, John, according to Bill, was largely insomniac, worked about 19 hours a day, hardly slept even with sleepers, and just drove himself to burnout.
Right. How old was he when he died then?
He was in his early 70s, but
he had
cancer at 29, cancer of the throat presumably very heavy smoking, which was operated but never properly successfully, so that at the end of his life he was on a food machine because he couldn't swallow or digest properly.
Yeah.
But throughout the 60s, you know, he looked the part. He was incredibly good looking, incredibly stylish. He had this vision. He was one ahead of everybody. Probably the speed of his metabolism at which he worked kept him always ahead.
Right.
Willing to risk colours, designs that others wouldn't.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about his background. Was he from Glasgow?
Yes, he was from a very poor background in Glasgow. The father and mother had a corner shop. John's mother, according to Bill, did dress quite stylishly. They were brothers and sisters. John, frustrated, alienated, disaffected, ran away to London at about the age of 18. Came to London with a vision to redesign the way men looked. Men were dressed in baggy, rather shapeless, formless clothes, which John, of course, wanted to correct. He worked for a time at Moss Brothers, where he learned to cut and learned about the sort of retail side of clothes, and then set up as a maverick. He and Bill Franks had a little bit of money to rent one room on Beak Street. They bought fabric, often having to sell the garment before they could pay for the fabric. And proceeded from there. It really was a rags-to-riches story, extraordinary one.
Yeah.
And, of course, everybody copied John Stephen in the 60s. Almost, Bill said, most people spent their time simply taking photographs of the windows and then went away and did the same line on a lesser style.
Yeah, yeah. So he would have... when was his first shop in Carnaby Street?
First shop in Carnaby Street was... 58. It was just called the Man Shop.
Wow.
They then opened up another one which became very legendary to mods called His Clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
It had very much a gay orientation to begin with because of the nature of the clothes, the effeminacy attached to them before they became not mainstream but incorporated into the whole pop ethos. And their clients were Jimi Hendrix, the Rolling Stones, the Who, whoever. Everybody went to Carnaby Street to buy John's clothes.
Because there is the sort of popular history will suggest that there was this issue of Town magazine, wasn't there, where Mark Bolan appears at the age of about 14 or something with these older boys, and this was 1962, and people tend to point to that as being the beginning of mod, but there are other people who say, well, that was the end of mod, actually, because that was as soon as that happened, it became popular.
Well, I think there was that hierarchy, wasn't there, of faces, tickets, numbers, so that the faces would have begun, in the late 50s by their extraordinary attention to detail and style.
Yeah.
And that would have run contemporaneous with John starting up
And
with the other shops that were around. There were a few. There was one that imported American Ivy League clothes.
Yeah.
I think you can correct me on the name.
Well, there was one called John Simon, which I think started out somewhere Windsor way, I think.
Yes.
But there were shops on Shaftesbury Avenue.
There were.
Cecil G.
Cecil G, that's
and,
right. Was another early...
Austin's, I think.
Austin's was the one for American apparel.
Yeah, Ravel shoes.
That's right.
Toppers. Anello and David.
That's right.
Which were... A lot of them were sort of theatrical clothing outfits,
they were,
weren't they?
Rather like Vince, who we just talked about earlier. Vince was more into theatrical types. John's great skill was to democratize clothes. He realized that youthful mods couldn't afford to go to places that were expensive, so that John democratized clothes, made them affordable, and made them very diverse. He was obsessive, so he would do one blue shirt in, say, 40 shades of blue, or one pink shirt in 40 shades of pink.
So a lot of them tended to be unique then?
Yes, absolutely unique. And he loved buying remnants. Go out, Bill said, and just buy remnants, make up half a dozen shirts and delete the line. So that for very competitive mods, style kept changing. So they had to have that one shirt. Bill said we had customers came in literally three times a day searching for anything new to wear in a club that had just come out.
Gosh, the time is hurtling past. I'm going to play... We sort of agreed to play a Who track.
Yes, of course.
I've changed the choice to this one because I particularly like the feedback Great. In this. I think the Pete Townsend bit in this is just absolutely fantastic. And I think he was really on his own in this kind
totally.
Of...
Totally.
I can go anyway.
Where aren't you?
I can live anyhow.
We don't lose.
I can go anywhere.
For something new.
Anyway, anyhow, anywhere I choose. Do anything.
Right or wrong.
I can talk anyhow.
And get along.
Don't care anyway.
I never lose.
Anyway, anyhow, anywhere I choose.
Incomparable.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Probably Pete Townsend, the greatest British guitarist ever.
Yes. I would, yeah, I mean, that's just, for the time, I mean, that's 64 or 65. I mean, to sort of use that sort of feedback in what is essentially a pop record yes. like that is pretty, no one else did that, I don't think.
No, and the extraordinary commitment to that compressed time band is unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
The Daughtry vocals, so powerful, intense against that backdrop.
Right. Great. All right. Well, we're talking to Jeremy Reid, author of The King of Carnaby Street, The Life of John Stephen, which is a great book, possibly the best or only book on the subject.
It's the only book on John Stephen and probably the only book ever to be on John Stephen, I would think. And
right. Did it sell well?
Not particularly,
no,
but
it's a shame.
There's film interest in it at present.
Oh, right. You've mentioned this before. There's a suggestion of a screenplay? Or
suggestions, yes. There right. is interest because it would, of course, make the ideal London mod movie, The King of Carnaby Street, the young man who comes to London and literally builds, designs and creates a whole street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Would you like to recite another poem? Before, as we've got about 6 minutes left, we can have one poem and one piece of music, I think.
Yes, we can. Let me choose a poem. I'm going to read a poem. I'll read a poem about what it's like to write all the time, called The Magic Islands. Wherever I go, it's mobile. It's my aura, like you see a rainbow smudged like indigo eyeshadow, stop off and impart it, back of a bookshop with friends, or share in little quantum jumps up on a third story, magic as resource, or call it poetry, poetry. Spontaneous networking, a fired up neurochemistry, or a white blob on Titan's northern hemisphere as alien intrusion, shipping a human body up the gravity curve, don't merit pursuit, but lyric makes it happen. I carry it as dazzle, spill it all around me, big as Africa, like I've done Hatton Garden as a jeweler's smash, got words instead of diamonds to sell on for cash.
Well, hello there, my, it's been a long time. How am I doing? You really want to know? Oh, I guess I'm doing fine. It's been so long now, but it seems like it was only yesterday. Ain't it funny? It's so funny how time can slip right on away. I want to ask you a question, is it all right? How's your new love? I wonder, can you truthfully say he's doing fine? You know, I heard something the other day. I heard you told him that you were gonna love him till the end of time. Well, that's the same thing that you told me. It seemed like just the other day. Funny, it's so funny how time can just slip right on away. I hate to leave you, baby, but I've gotta go now. Oh, I guess I'll see you somewhere around. But here's one thing you just can't tell. You don't know when, though. You never can tell when Joe Hinton will come back in town. But here's what I want you to do. Oh, please remember what I told you. That in time, you're gonna pay. Ain't it funny? It's funny how time slips away.
Well, that might be a perfect note to end on.
I think so.
That was Joe Hinton from 1964, Funny How Time Slips Away. And that comes from an album called Georgie Fame Heard Them Here First.
Extraordinary vocal.
Absolutely. So thank you very much to Jeremy Reed.
Thank you very much, William, for having me.
Poet and writer, for coming on. What have you got coming up? Have you got a performance anywhere? What's happening?
Yes, I'll be performing at the Hoss Hospital June the 28th and May the 18th at the Soho Library on St Martin's Lane.
Oh, okay. And what will you be doing? What's
performing poetry, much as I've done today, except except with the accompaniment of musicians.
Okay. And who are your musicians? Tell us a little. Who what do they play?
Jerry McNee plays laptop pre-prepared sound, and Maria Christina plays sort of psychedelic harp.
Okay.
Yeah, we're quite a unique genre in that nobody else uses electro beats with poetry and with that sort of arrangement.
Oh, you didn't tell me about the last poem you read. What was that called and where's that from?
The last poem that I read, Magic Island, was from a book called Red Light Blues, which came out 3 years ago. It was published by Society Club, who were in Soho.
Great. All right, Jeremy. Jeremy Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, William.
Wavelength. And you're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.